Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel, concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. Reading this week from the February 25th, 2022 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is a bar scene. There's a lot of young people smiling and laughing. At the bar is the Democratic donkey. He's about to get his beer. He has a very concerned look on his face. He's got his mask. He's got it hanging from one ear, and he's just pulled it off of his face. And the headline is, "A Taste of Normalcy. Is it time for Democratic states to drop their mask mandates?" And I believe we picked that up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Putin claims troop drawback seeks negotiations. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin said this week he was pulling back some troops from the Ukrainian border and is open to a diplomatic path out of the crisis, easing fears of an imminent invasion. But President Biden cautioned that Putin's claims of a drawback were unverified and said an invasion remains very much a possibility. Many Western nations evacuated their embassies over the past week, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warned Sunday that a major military action could begin at any time. But cracks appeared early in the week as Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told Putin in a televised appearance that diplomatic options were far from exhausted, and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky floated the possibility that Ukraine will abandon its dream of joining NATO, a key Russian demand. After meeting with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Putin said he was ready to continue on the negotiating track. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called Moscow's diplomatic overtures grounds for cautious optimism. In an address, Biden vowed to give diplomacy every chance to succeed, but he warned that more than 150,000 troops remained in a threatening position and reiterated his vow that an invasion will be met with crippling banking and technology sanctions. If there's an attack, he said, the world will not forget that Russia chose needless death and destruction. What the editorial said. Whether Putin stands down or orders a bloody military assault, the Ukraine crisis has driven home a valuable lesson, said the Washington Post. Democracy survival is intertwined with geopolitics. Allowing a forcible anti-democratic takeover of Ukraine would open the door for the intimidation or takeover of other nations, which is definitely not in the interest of the U.S. and other Western democracies. The answer to authoritarian aggression is alliance cohesion, exactly what the Biden administration has achieved by wrangling NATO countries into a unified show of support for Ukraine. Putin's hostilities underline a new world disorder, said the Wall Street Journal. From China to Russia to Iran, the world's rogues are on the march, spreading aggression and disorder that threatens American freedom and prosperity. At this time of grave peril, Biden must meet the moment explained to an American public wearied by Iraq and Afghanistan the dangers of isolationism and shift his focus from expanding the domestic welfare state to improving national security. He must substantially raise his defense budget requests and seek alliances with GOP hawks who understand the dangers ahead. What the columnist said, nobody knows for sure why Putin appeared to put on the brakes, said David Lenart in the New York Times. One possibility is that he's been bluffing all along, a view held by many leaders in Ukraine and Europe. Another is that the show of Western unity and resistance among Ukraine's citizenry made him back down. Give Biden credit, said Thomas Friedman, also in the Times. His statecraft has given Putin pause. The arms transfer to Ukraine, the movement of troops to Eastern Europe, and threats of painful new sanctions may have the Russian autocrat wondering, if the invasion goes badly, wrecking Russia's economy and resulting in Russian soldiers returning home in body bags, could it lead to my own downfall? It's possible Putin will still invade, but he might be looking for a face-saving way out of this confrontation, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. He wants a guarantee that Ukraine will never join NATO, and was probably pleased to hear Zelensky say that NATO membership may not be feasible. And if Putin's goal was to strengthen his hold over Ukraine and divide the West, he badly miscalculated. Instead, his aggressions have sparked a rise in Ukrainian nationalism and unified NATO more than any event since the end of the Cold War. As the West ponders Putin's next move, said Yaroslav Trofimov in the Wall Street Journal, it's clear that the danger to Ukraine will remain no matter what. Putin sees a thriving democratic Ukraine as a direct threat to his autocratic rule, so he will continue to seek its destabilization by preserving the possibility of invasion. So far, the Russians have failed, said Oleksiy Danilov, the head of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council. But this doesn't mean they won't try again tomorrow or the day after. Controversy of the week. Mask mandates. Is it time to show our faces again? Sunday's Super Bowl marked our unofficial return to normality, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. After 2 years of pandemic restrictions, the nationally televised sight of a stadium packed with 70,000 almost entirely maskless fans in the liberal stronghold of Los Angeles, no less, sent a strong signal that, as a culture, we are ready for the end. Days earlier, the Democratic governors of 11 blue states reacted to the plunge in Omicron cases by announcing the imminent lifting of indoor mask mandates, an action most Republican governors took last summer. It's about time, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. But let's be clear. Democrats' sudden shift on masking policy isn't based on any change in the science. They're simply scared that exhausted Americans are far more annoyed by the restrictions than they are scared by the virus, and are ready to wreak vengeance in the November midterm elections on the party of endless safetyism. Oh, those wily Democrats, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. When they supported masks, distancing, and other precautions to curb the pandemic, it was a secret plot, first to cost Donald Trump the 2020 election, then to impose totalitarian social control. Now that many Democratic governors want to lift restrictions as they previously did before the Delta wave last summer, it's a scheme to win the 2022 elections. The less convoluted explanation is that Democrats are, in fact, following the science, and that mandates are being lifted because the Omicron wave is subsiding and new COVID cases are plummeting, down two-thirds in only 3 weeks. Nor has there been any sea change in public opinion, said Anthony Salvanto in CBSNews.com. A new CBS poll finds that 56% of Americans still support mask mandates for indoor public places. Among Democrats, 85% want mask mandates to continue for now. For schools in particular, lifting mask mandates is premature and irresponsible, said Natalia Linos in the Boston Globe. COVID may be relatively mild for most kids, but it has killed nearly 1,000 children in the U.S., far more than the flu's usual death toll. Schools, with their crowded classrooms and cafeterias, easily spread the virus throughout a community. As a parent, I'm as keen as anyone to see my kids enjoy a normal childhood, but that includes keeping schools open. The data is clear that mask mandates reduce outbreaks. That's why the CDC still recommends masking in schools and other crowded indoor places. The CDC also recommends avoiding medium-rare hamburgers, said David Leonard in the New York Times. Scientists naturally err on the side of caution, but it's the job of elected officials to make hard choices about trade-offs, balancing the benefits of mask mandates and other restrictions with their cost, including isolation, frustration, and depression. Children in particular desperately need relief from mask, fear, and distancing. With so many Americans either vaccinated against COVID or carrying antibodies from a natural infection, it's time to take steps toward normalcy. COVID is still killing more than 2,000 Americans a day, said Catherine Wu in The Atlantic, and no one should go diving into a maskless mosh pit. But it's now clear that COVID may always be with us, and delayed gratification doesn't work so well when the delay has no clear end in sight. For vaccinated and boosted people, this phase of the pandemic can be defined less by what we can't do and more by what we safely, carefully, finally can. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for forensics, after authorities used a DNA database to send British man Paul Bishop a set of false teeth he vomited into a trash can during a drunken night out in Spain 11 years ago. Someone has definitely cleaned them up, a delighted Bishop said. It was a good week for movie memes, after a Malaysian domestic flight was rerouted when passengers spotted a live snake slithering through the plane's light fixtures. And it was a good week for holes, after a corrugated iron doghouse from Costa Rica that was punctured by a meteorite in 2019 was put up for auction, with an expected sales price of up to $300,000. Christie said collectors will treasure an object hit by an extraterrestrial object. But it was a bad week for soup Nazis, after Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene accused Speaker Nancy Pelosi of sending the gazpacho police to spy on Republican members of Congress. Greene, who frequently uses Nazi analogies, was apparently reaching for the word Gestapo. It was a bad week for idle hands, with reports that a bored security guard working his first day at an art gallery in Yekaterinburg, Russia, used a ballpoint pen to add eyes to the faceless people in Anna Lefbarskaya's Three Figures, a painting valued at $1 million. The gallery said it hoped the damage could be eliminated without consequence. And it was a bad week for Netflix subscribers who received the exciting news by email of a price update that will allow us to deliver even more value for your membership. The email never mentions that the updated price is higher than the old one. And here's a short news piece. Biden advisor held COVID vaccine stock. President Biden's top science advisor, Eric Lander, held stock in COVID-19 vaccine maker BioNTech worth between $500,000 and $1 million more than 2 months into his tenure. Politico reported this week. Lander, who recently resigned after he was accused of berating and demeaning colleagues, had 90 days after taking the position to divest his stock. He waited 69 days before selling his shares of BioNTech, the German partner on Pfizer's COVID vaccine. By then, BioNTech stock had hit its second highest price ever. The day before he sold, Lander wrote about the importance of vaccines in the Washington Post without disclosing his stake. A spokesperson for the agency Lander ran said that promoting vaccines was not even close to an ethics concern. The briefing this week is the electric vehicle revolution. Battery-powered cars and trucks are selling briskly. Will they soon rule the road? What's changed? Electric vehicles have become the hottest cars on the market. Demand for vehicles that run solely on batteries is so great that some buyers are forced to pay deposits months before their car is available. In a recent Pew survey, 39% of Americans said they're likely to make their next car electric. With auto tailpipes the single greatest source of the U.S. emissions, the federal government is heavily incentivizing the switch to electric, offering $7,500 in federal tax rebates. Tesla, the reigning king of electric vehicles, EVs, sold nearly a million cars globally last year, up 87%, while sales for Ford's and GM's internal combustion vehicles slumped. Europe, with EVs making up 14% of all vehicles sold in 2021, and China with 9%, are further along than the U.S., which had 3%. But U.S. automakers are moving rapidly to electrify their fleets, as globally the industry invests $500 billion in new plants and technology. It's one of the biggest industrial transformations probably in the history of capitalism, Scott Kill, chief executive of Volkswagen Group of America, told the New York Times. The investments are massive, and the mission is massive. Why are buyers so hot on EVs? Eliminating tailpipe emissions remains the top reason for going electric, but EVs have rapidly evolved. With their futuristic design and high-torque motors, electric cars are now widely seen as powerful, high-tech, and cool, even a status symbol. Ford's fully electric Lightning version of its F-150 pickup truck is the quickest F-150 ever built, going 0 to 60 miles per hour in 4.4 seconds, and it can tow up to 10,000 pounds. Ford had to cap pre-orders at 200,000. We're going to be able to sell every one we can build, a Ford official said. Tesla's Cybertruck, which starts at $39,900 and looks like it's from a science fiction movie set decades from now, generated 250,000 orders within days of debuting. Not only does the average EV save owners $500 annually on fuel costs, The price of the vehicles dropped 10.8% last year. Some buyers like the fact that EVs, which have no engine under the hood, offer a second trunk. Others like the ability to use the battery as a portable generator and power source. Ohio business owner Eddie Berry plans to use his Lightning to power an electric smoker and TV at Ohio State football tailgates. "I'm going to be the guy everybody's talking about," he says. What's the battery's range? It varies widely, with a full charging power, 110 miles of driving in a Mini Cooper electric, to 373 miles for some Teslas. GM says its next generation of lithium ion batteries will have a range up to 450 miles. But there are many variables, including speed and even weather, since it takes a lot of juice to heat an EV without the thermal output of a traditional engine. As a result, the biggest obstacle to EV adoption is range anxiety, the fear of running out of power, especially on long drives. There are now roughly 50,000 charging stations in the U.S. Last year's infrastructure bill allocated $5 billion to build 500,000 charging stations, but it will take years to reach that goal. Expensive chargers can fully replenish an EV's battery in as little as 15 minutes, while the more common kind takes up to 20 hours. How green are these cars? Only as green as the grid that charges them. In Poland, driving an EV actually generates more carbon emissions because the grid is so coal-reliant, whereas in France, which runs its grid largely on nuclear energy, driving an EV results in 96% carbon savings. In the U.S., the average EV emits 200 grams of carbon dioxide per mile, compared with 385 grams for the fuel-efficient Toyota Camry, or 636 grams for a gas F-150. Benefits are already visible, with Southern California, which has embraced EVs, seeing a 4% drop in nitrogen oxide emissions from passenger cars. Mining the lithium, cobalt, and nickel needed for modern batteries also takes considerable energy and water, although scientists say the environmental impact of oil drilling and pipelines is far worse. What does the future hold? It will take years and a major cultural shift to replace the 280 million cars and trucks on U.S. roads. But automakers plan to make their fleets fully electric by 2035. There are plans for more than a dozen EV and battery factories in the U.S., including four new GM plants in Michigan and others in Georgia, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Tennessee. FedEx, Walmart, and Hertz have made huge EV orders. Change hasn't come this fast since the Model T rolled off the assembly lines. "It's like moving from the horse to the car," said Andy Palmer, a former Nissan executive who helped launch the first mass-produced electric car. "It's that seismic." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with "The Cost of Embracing Gambling." For decades, our country limited legal gambling to Las Vegas, Atlantic City, and some Native American casinos, said Ross Douthat. This limited permission for people to bet on games of chance and sports was necessary, because if you over-police it, gambling goes underground. But in 2018, the Supreme Court ruled that any state could legalize gambling on pro sports. And 30 states and pro leagues began succumbing to the siren song of billions in new revenues. This week's Super Bowl marked a turning point. With a flood of ads for sports gambling companies before and during an event viewed by 112 million viewers, the thin wall separating the games from the gambling industry was visibly torn away. The NFL and the legal gambling industry are now partners in a scheme to separate many millions of non-wealthy Americans from their money. With a smartphone, you can now gamble on sports 24/7. For many, betting on football and other sports will be a harmless diversion. But for some, it will devolve into a costly habit they can't afford, or a full-blown addiction that ruins their lives. The easier it is to gamble, the more unhappy outcomes you'll get. A court in conflict with the majority. The Supreme Court is on a collision course with a demographically and culturally changing America, said Ronald Brownstein. The court's conservatives, especially the five to the right of Chief Justice John Roberts, represent the tip of a spear of the conservative coalition of restoration, which aims to undo much of legal precedent of the past 50 years. Clearly allying themselves with a shrinking group of mostly white, rural Christian conservatives, the five justices appear poised to declare affirmative action unconstitutional, uphold state restrictions on voting rights, strike down environmental and workplace regulations, expand gun rights in blue states, weaken church-state separation, and dramatically roll back abortion rights. This exercise in raw power will create great conflict and turmoil. In a recent PRRI poll, for example, 63% of Americans say Roe v. Wade was rightly decided. Consider last week's ruling on the Alabama redistricting case, in which the conservative justices, over Roberts' objection, let stand the legislature's blatant use of racial gerrymandering to herd most black voters into a single district. The 6-3 conservative majority is clearly eager to impose a partisan ideology. But how long will rising generations put up with a court dedicated to restoring the America of the 1950s? This is an international column from China. An American-born Olympic hero. She may have been born and raised in San Francisco, but Eileen Gu is China's own superstar, said Wang Qi and Kui Fondi in the Global Times. The 18-year-old freestyle skier captured gold in the women's free ski big air event after choosing to compete for China, her mother's native land, rather than the U.S., where she still lives. Gu's final run made Chinese spectators breathless as she pulled off a double cork 1620, spinning 4.5 times while rotating twice in midair. It was the first gold in snow sports that China, which is not a traditional Winter Olympics powerhouse, has ever won. "This is the best moment in my life," Gu said, thanking the Chinese audience for its support. Gu has received adoration from Chinese social media users, including new era Chinese teens who relate to her simultaneous embrace of her Chinese roots and her Western cultural upbringing. It's made Gu a commercial hit. She stands to earn more than $15 million in sponsorship deals from about 30 domestic and foreign brands that sponsor her. Yet in the U.S., Gu is being attacked by jingoistic right-wing talking heads, said John Gong in CGTN.com. Tucker Carlson aired a segment with fellow Fox News host Will Kane, who called Gu ungrateful and shameful for her decision to represent China. Kane then attacked Gu's American corporate sponsors, accusing them of betraying the United States for Chinese riches. Of course, Gu's sponsors also back U.S. athletes, and she's not the only naturalized athlete competing for another country. Even the U.S. has team members born abroad. Yet the U.S. media never fusses about them, says Zai Winsin in Global Times. Some Americans adopt this double standard because, for them, only the West can win. And if the West loses a star, it's not fair. Yet the U.S. became a global power by attracting global talent, so why shouldn't China do the same? Criticizing Gu for choosing China is just another example of American elites' calculated snobbery. The world outside China doesn't hate Eileen Gu, said James Matthey in News.com from Australia, but it's deeply troubled by her high-profile role in China's propaganda war. Gu has remained silent about China's myriad human rights abuses, including the genocide of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. When Pin Shua, the tennis star who dropped the game after accusing a high-level government official of sexual assault, appeared at the skiing final, Gu said she was grateful Ping was happy and healthy and doing her thing. A strange way to describe someone who was forcibly silenced. These controversies made Gu the perfect face of the Olympics, said Bruce Arthur in the Toronto Star. The International Olympic Committee abetted Beijing in sweeping Chinese human rights abuses under the rug. That's not the fault of Gu, a steely competitor who, with a sweet ferocity, almost designed to insulate her from bad faith criticism. But like it or not, she now exists at the intersection of the world's geopolitics. And that's exactly where the IOC and Beijing want her to be. And it's time for The Last Word, our feature article, this week titled, What's Your Good Name Worth? Reputation fixers promise to remove false information from the Internet, said journalist Paul Gallant in The Walrus. They are costly and often closely tied to the very websites that spread the slander in the first place. In the mid-2000s, Matt Earle was an internet marketer for an offshore bank in Bermuda, helping draw in new customers. Impressed with his skills, corporate clients hired him to boost their profiles online. But Earle soon realized that they would also pay to bury bad news, scandals, lawsuits, or run-ins with financial regulators. He returned to Toronto in 2010, and the next year launched Reputation.ca, a company that provides digital makeovers, helping people regain control over how they appear on the internet. Earle became what is called a reputation fixer, joining an industry today worth, according to one estimate, $240 million annually. Reputation fixers run the spectrum from high-profile PR firms such as Toronto-based Navigator, which former CBC host Jean Gomeshi first turned to in 2014 when he was embroiled in assault accusations, to smaller, scrappier services like Earl's. Many Reputation.ca clients or businesses worried about the effect of scathing customer reviews or social media rants from disgruntled ex-employees. One 2020 survey found that negative feedback on public forums like Yelp or Facebook can drive away 92% of consumers. But Earl and his competitors also hear from individuals. Students humiliated by an explicit photo on a revenge porn website. Professionals desperate to expunge trash talk from a former client's blog. Or CEOs who can't shake outdated news stories that keep popping up on Google. The internet has a long memory. Cleaning up your image, however, is not cheap. A serious campaign can cost between $10,000 and $20,000 or more and will usually run for at least 4 to 8 months. Earl's 24 staff members deploy a suite of tactics to dilute or outright remove unwanted content. They have methods for contacting satisfied customers and encouraging them to leave positive reviews to bump up star-rated averages. They are also able to tweak Wikipedia entries in ways that pass muster with the website's volunteer editors, who can be relentless about deleting puffery. Appeals can be filed to major internet players like Facebook, Google, and Twitter in order to hide damaging link or critical comments. If it's an unflattering story in the mainstream press, staff might provide the publication with research that prompts a correction or clarification. If that's not enough, there's the nuclear option: disappearing the content entirely. Almost all credible newspapers have a no removal policy, said Earl. It's sometimes different with blogs, independent news, or review websites. Since they don't necessarily follow journalistic codes of conduct, they can be nagged, paid off, coerced, or threatened with lawyers' letters into deleting material. We do whatever we can to get content removed, says Earl. But the help that reputation fixers provide the shamed and the bullied, and the profits they extract from them, may also be incentivizing the shamers and the bullies. This is the dark side of online reputation management. Websites can make money by removing the hurtful material they encouraged others to post in the first place. These publishers are often based outside North America and can be part of larger networks that share content widely. They might operate for a few months before disappearing, only to have their post appear on another site with a different name. Whether they target businesses or individuals, call themselves consumer advocacy sites or gossip sites, the content is never fact-checked, universally negative, and almost always designed to harm. In the same way that paying hostage takers can inadvertently create a market for hostage taking, the booming market for reputation fixing appears to be encouraging more online defamation and an ecosystem to manage it. Do reputation fixers put everybody's reputation at risk? This man not only has a major drug issue, he made me do crazy sexual things that I wasn't comfortable with. He cheated on me with another guy, reads a newly deleted post in The Dirty, published, as is typical, under the heading that includes the name and photo of the subject. Founded in 2007, The Dirty publishes anonymous tips about average people, including Canadians, on the platform that resembles a celebrity news site. Users can browse stories by city, scrolling through seemingly endless allegations of cheating, fraud, sexually transmitted diseases, and general lasciviousness. Though The Dirty has a list of prohibited content, including false, defamatory material, hate speech, pornography, revenge porn, and images of minors, a visitor might be shocked by what does get posted. "We are not the truth police," reads their legal FAQ. "We cannot resolve factual disputes between strangers. Therefore, we will not remove posts simply because one party makes an unproven claim that a post contains false information. Still, the post on many of these sites can be removed for a price. Some, such as badgirlreports.date or cheaters.news, run sidebar ads for reputation fixer services. The website Ripoff Report openly charges businesses to monitor and control what's said about them on its pages. Others, like The Dirty, have cooperative relationships with reputation fixers that allow those companies to boast a 100% removal rate. According to court documents, between 2016 and 2017, Brandon Rock, a Vancouver-based geopolitical and business consultant, was called a drunk, a cheater, and a liar in almost 100 posts on social media and websites, including The Dirty. The court awarded Rook $200,000 in damages plus costs against his ex-girlfriend. Rook had hired an expert to link the false comments to an IP address associated with her home Wi-Fi. But even before his case was completed, he gave $29,870 to reputation consultants. Rook's successful court case now fills up most of the search results for his name. It's hard to find a single unpleasant item about him. Monit Zamel, a commercial litigator and internet lawyer who teaches at Ryerson University, says that some reputation-fixing services, not those previously mentioned, have connections to extortion sites. Businesses may discover a negative review only after a removal service points it out and offers help. On other occasions, personal details shared with Reputation Fixer have even showed up on these sites. The victims fall victim to these Good Samaritans. They enter into a contract with them. They pay them a lot of money, she says. The URL disappears. Then a week later, new URLs appear with the exact same content. Then the victim falls prey again and pays them more money. Most of Zamel's clients come to her after spending tens of thousands of dollars on reputation management services that ultimately fail to get rid of stories about their supposed promiscuity or pedophilia. Yet she admits that the legal process, as painful and as expensive as it is, often does no better. Suing somebody, whether for defamation or invasion of privacy, doesn't always fix the problem. The information can remain out there. Worse, legal action can exacerbate the damage. You're putting into a public document and filing with the court the very allegations you don't want exposed. There's also little the law can do to dissuade someone who is determined. In 2018, 52 businesses and individuals were involved in a civil action against Nader Atas, an Ontario real estate agent who had been fired from her job in the 1990s. The court determined that over almost two decades, Atas had posted an extraordinary amount of false material, almost 13,000 defamatory statements about people and people connected to people she believed had wronged her. In January 2021, the Ontario Superior Court ruled in favor of the complainants. The following month, Atas was arrested for harassment and libel. She was let out on bail under the condition she not contact the individuals or their associates directly or indirectly. She was also banned from using any device capable of connecting to the internet. According to the New York Times, some plaintiffs hired reputation fixers to deal with the offending material and moved on. But Atas, it seems, kept at it. Luke Grollo is an IT professional whose online detective work was instrumental in building the case against her. He had married the daughter of the man who fired Atas, which was enough for the real estate agent to call Grelot's child a pedophile. In March, he discovered that Atos may have picked up right where she left off, targeting four new victims, including the daughter of a New York Times editor Atos had attacked last year after he refused to kill an article about her case. Tracking Atos's relentlessness, Grelot said, has consumed me to the core. For the moment, solutions are scarce. The ease and simplicity that has made online life convenient and empowering has also been convenient and empowering for those acting out of malice and for those who see financial opportunity in those urges. This bizarre online reputation economy exists primarily because of Section 230 of the U.S. Communications Decency Act, passed in 1996. It protects internet companies, whether Google or ShishaHomeWrecker.com, from liability when something illegal is posted by others on their site. Without that law, platforms would be overwhelmed by the need to vet the vast quantity of user-generated content they depend on. Because so many of these websites are hosted in the U.S., and because borders mean so little on the internet, and because it's hard to get one country's law enforced in another, Section 230 has had a global impact. By contrast, the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act, passed in 1998, does compel websites to act on copyrighted material users publish, and as a result, most mainstream platforms have a process for removing it. In fact, some people trying to get certain kinds of unwanted content removed, say a photo of them with pedophile superimposed on it, will claim copyright infringement rather than defamation because the removal process is more clear-cut. According to Zimmel, Google will obey American court orders to de-index sites, that is, to delete them from search results, based on copyright infringement. But until recently, has only voluntarily de-indexed material that's allegedly defamatory. The results depend on which of the company's moderators is handling the request. HONR Network, a Florida-based nonprofit founded to protect people from online abuse, has had success persuading Google to de-index pages on behalf of the victims it represents. HONR volunteers helped get close to 2,000 pieces of content about Grelot's family removed. In June, Google announced changes to its algorithm so that people slandered on multiple websites will have search results automatically suppressed. None of it, however, is particularly easy for an ordinary person worried what an employer will see during a Google search, never mind for a bullied teenager. Emily Laidlaw, an associate professor at the University of Calgary's Faculty of Law, who has written about online harm, has proposed legislative reform to allow online tribunals to solve defamation and harassment disputes before they end up in courtroom. Such tribunals, she argues, can specialize in ways traditional courts can't, providing a greater range of tools to fix reputational harm, such as outside experts to scrub content from search results. The narrative that was out there for a long time was, if you don't like what's going on, don't go online. Don't participate online. That's no longer a supportable view. We're all online in our personal and professional lives, said Laidlaw. While Earl has built a multi-million-dollar business on saving people and companies from embarrassment, he agrees that it's become too easy to defame people. You can sit there and cause $50,000 worth of reputation damage in an afternoon. A version of this story was originally published by The Walrus. On the Talking Points page, we have an article titled Trump's Documents, A Trail of Destruction. It looks like former President Trump flushed history down a White House toilet, said Jonathan Allen in NBCNews.com. A new book by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman reveals that White House staff repeatedly had to unclog a toilet in the upstairs residence that Trump stuffed with wads of torn up documents. This report, which Trump called a fake story, follows the news that many official documents turned over to the House January 6th Select Committee had been ripped up and taped back together. Last week, we also learned that after a prolonged fight with the National Archives, Trump relinquished 15 boxes to office records of official records he'd taken to Mar-a-Lago, including some marked top secret. The archives referred that apparent violation to the Presidential Record Act to the Justice Department. What great irony, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton deleted emails she said were private in 2016, and indignant Trump proclaimed, "People who have nothing to hide don't destroy evidence to keep it from being publicly archived as required under federal law." Now, inquiring minds would like to know what it was that Trump was hiding when he deliberately and persistently ripped up, flushed, and stole so many documents. Like so many Trump scandals, this news astonished nobody, said Jack Schaefer in Politico. Before and during his presidency, Trump habitually cheated, lied, and brazenly defied laws and norms, assuming he'd never be punished. Trump, like Nixon, has taught us that the honor system can't work if the president has no innate sense of honor. Trump might finally pay a price for his arrogance, said Chris Trowell in The Bulwark. Under federal law, it's a felony to conceal, remove, mutilate, obliterate, or destroy a federal record. Anyone convicted under that statute is disqualified from ever again holding public office, which would rule out another Trump run in 2024. To get a conviction, the Justice Department would have to prove that Trump knew he was breaking the law when he destroyed documents. But that shouldn't be hard. Trump was repeatedly warned that tearing up documents was illegal by White House counsel Don McGahn and his first two chiefs of staff, Rince Priebus and John Kelly. Trump's only truthful defense would be that he believed that laws like the one he violated were for little people and not for him. And a few shorter notes. Official Omicron case counts in the U.S. represent only 20 to 25% of actual infections, since many of those who got the virus did not get reportable tests, says Seattle epidemiologist Trevor Bedford. At the Omicron wave's January peak, Bedford estimates, new infections in the U.S. may have exceeded 3 million a day, with as much as 10% of the nation's populace infected at any given time. Only 34% of office workers have returned to their desks, and thousands of companies have yet to announce return dates. Meanwhile, restaurants are about three-quarters full, air travel is 80% of pre-pandemic numbers, and attendance at NBA games is at 93%. U.S. police fatally shot at least 1,055 people last year, up from 1,021 in 2020 and 999 in 2019. The fact that the number of citizens killed by police has remained at about 1,000 per year for 7 years, said criminologist Andrew Wheeler, suggests there have been no major changes in police use of deadly force. The number of pedestrians killed by vehicles has climbed 46% over the past decade. And last year, New Mexico, New Jersey, Utah, and Texas posted their highest pedestrian fatality numbers on record. Experts point to the larger, heavier vehicles on the road and motorists' pandemic-fueled anger and recklessness. On the poll watch, 50% of U.S. adults think it is likely that a future election in the United States will be overturned for partisan reasons, including 56% of Democrats and 48% of Republicans. 56% say they have little or no confidence that American elections will reflect the will of the people, up from 52% who felt that way in September and 40% in January of 2021. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from recently passed Betty White, quoted in Good Housekeeping, who says, "You don't luck into integrity. You work at it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander and Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander and Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.